We all tell ourselves stories of who we are and why. But we forget that we have the power to define them. That no idea grows from mewling striped cub to teeth at your throat tiger without a little help, some guidance, and a whole lot of love along the way. I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers.
There was a robot, an automaton, that was, the idea was it was just going to walk across the states and people were going to interact with it. It got as far as, I think, Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, and then was brutally destroyed, sitting on a bench. It could just have been stupid vandals or whatever. The motive is unclear. But it did not get very far before somebody decided that the most interesting thing to do to this was destroy it. Or if not most interesting, most compelling thing to do to it.
And it could be for the most simple reason, like you wanted to break it apart to see if it had some...
Right, it could have just been, it could have been scavenging alone.
Copper or old gold or whatever kind of metal he wants to scrap metal.
Yeah, we have a lot of that now. I think there was some footage of it. I forget. This happened a while back. But the... I remember I had a conversation with you maybe a couple months ago where you were talking about AI in the context of writing. And I half-handedly said, I could see a point where myself, having drafted all the material, would be happy giving the raw, the audio, the handwritten, et cetera, and walking through the AI to assemble it and execute it and visualize it, et cetera. And I know that we do that now, and that usually involves a plethora of other humans. And I would just as easily like to have $1 million+ or, you know, millions of dollars and hire people if I had that resource available. And I think this gets to one of the cores of AI or any new technology and how it pans out. As with the printing press, there becomes a point where not only the wealthiest or most capable in terms of resources have access to the tool, just as with the digital camera change and how that changed the filmmaking process. The old cameras were hundreds of thousands of dollars, heavy shoulder mounted. There was a large burden physically and financially to creating film. I can just as easily now create film on my phone or another portable device and edit that for free outside of paying for the equipment, which in some places can still be prohibitively expensive, or the internet access too. But even then, I can go to a library or other public space or, you know, make the investment in the moment. There, my point is that AI democratizes the creative process. I'm talking particularly about like Midjourney and a number and all these others, ChatGPT, et cetera, in a way we're not really ready for. And I don't think we ever could be.
One of the things that I developed in the work I did in computer science is where I developed the tools that out of a screenplay creates a blender. With voices, with words and everything. We applied for a patent and, you know, that is done. And now we are submitting the articles. It can be public knowledge. So basically, I developed this tool together with my students and a colleague. And, you know, the idea is very simple. It's an integrated set of different apps, different software that reads a screenplay in the standard Hollywood format of screenplays. And then creates everything else. It identifies the characters. It uses the characteristics of the characters to determine the corresponding shapes. Creates the voices based on the age and the gender, and reads the text and puts them the characters moving and speaking the lines and going from one place to the other. And it's a little rudimentary. No, it's not like exacting filmmaking, of course, but
it's where VR was originally. Yeah.
But if you're a screenplay writer, and like my, I divide these tools, I'm sure other tools will come. If you're a screenplay writer, then what, you know, you can make your own film. I think writers are misunderstanding what artificial intelligence is bringing them to them. You know, they're not making not only the writers no longer needed, they're also making the studios no longer needed. And so you can do... At first, it's just like a blender movie or a slightly not so good cartoon movie, but this will change. You know, you can put natural rendering, artificial rendering in top, and then it's George Lucas's dream. He wrote Star Wars, he puts it in the program, and the software does Star Wars exactly as George Lucas wanted, and no one will want to see it because it's 5 hours long, and they talk about midichlorians and about the social infrastructure of the empire. And so everybody quits and goes away, but he has his perfect film.
That is a system for one audience member, him. I think fundamentally the danger of AI is not so much, and I'm talking about this within the current context of as a generative resource, is not so much in its inherent functionality per se, or even access, because the access is fairly, you know, it's not like a lot of these are things you even have to pay for to use right now. That probably will change. It inevitably will change. I think the biggest issue becomes a few things. Here's the first. The AI does not act in a void. So for instance, people were annoying the auteur writer Wes Anderson with reinterpretations of existing films in Wes Anderson style. I think they're hilarious. I think he should laugh.
Like Lord of the Rings, right? Lord of the Rings, yes. In Wes Anderson's
time. I saw that trailer and went, you know what? I do actually want to see Wes Anderson direct that. I want to see Cervantes write the Bible, right? Like, I would like to see Cervantes take all of the testimonies and just do a series on that. He's dead. But if we could have a bot Cervantes, you know, take all the testimonies, apocryphal, ruled out, et cetera, and just go, hey, you know what? I'm going to Don Quixote this. Right. And they're going to yell at each other and argue and debate whose story is whose, et cetera.
Right.
But that would be fascinating. It would make it a living document again. The problem is, regardless of what kind of thing the AI nowadays generates, be it text, video, audio, visual, or so on, it is stealing other people's work to do it with blatant disregard for whether or not they gave permission for the work they made to be used in that purpose. In that context.
Okay. Now it comes a question that is very, you see, a couple of weeks ago, Pope Francis came to Portugal.
Okay.
So this was only for young people. Okay. This was World Youth Day or something like that. So it's a Catholic celebration that brings all young people from all across the world. They do it every 3-4 years. And this time it was in Lisbon. So in the last day, if you're a grown up, you can go. Okay. If you're older than 30, even if you're, this is for younger than 30 people, okay? So I would exclude it, but you can go in the last day. But as he was in Portugal, Pope Francis, there was a lot of presentations and discussions. And he has, and I'm mentioning like this because Pope Francis is maybe, most people would classify him as left to extreme left wing, okay?
Okay.
So somewhat between socialism and communism, which is makes sense given that he's a Jesuit and in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, that does make sense.
In the Catholic Church, there are kind of political factions or inclinations, like just like in every other human organization. And I would say that Opus Dei is more right wing.
A little.
Jesuits are left wing. And then there's all the other groups, and Franciscans also mostly left-wing, Dominicans mostly right-wing. It's more or less the way it's separated.
Sure.
It's funny because in the Inquisition, you would have a prosecutor that was a Dominican, and you had a defense lawyer, which was a Franciscan. But the reason why I mentioned this is because he's proposing a new type of economy that is arguing for the issue of if property makes sense, conceptually speaking, not even...
Right. I mean, for a lot of intellectual property law now, including, I think, how the WIPO, World Intellectual Property Organization, which is a branch of the UN, operates, is predicated on the idea that you own what you create unless you give any of that away, and to what extent. It's also largely what Creative Commons is built on. You only give the permissions that you give. And that's the backbone for a lot of communal sites on the internet that have emerged.
Right. And the thing is, the reason, and I'm saying that the question exists. I'm not claiming a size.
No, I know. Yeah.
I'm saying that this is an argument that is ongoing. This is an argument that went on going to the COVID vaccination, to the AIDS vaccines, who owns the patent and
who when owns can your information, how they can use it, yes.
And when can it be overruled?
When can you make them stop using it? Right.
Right. Now in Israel, there's the issue of when can democracy control the legal system?
Yeah. When can you say the courts don't have the final say?
Right. When can you do that? And of course, if you have a good legal system, then you are arguing for, no, let's keep the legal system independent of all the idiots that are doing the policies, you know? But if your legal system is corrupt to the bone, the fact that you have no way for the government to intervene in it can also be annoying.
Right. It's why the argument in the States, for instance, of adding seats on the Supreme Court or giving term limits to Supreme Court judges has a lot of deep implications.
Right.
And they are things that should be discussed and continuously discussed. It's not a conversation we should have once.
Right. Because, of course, when the Supreme Court says that slavery is anti-constitutional, you have one group applauding. When the Supreme Court says that abortion is not a federal right, then you have another group applauding, and they are not the same group.
Not usually, no.
Yeah, but that is the issue of democracies, which goes back to the issue: why do people have different opinions about things? Which for me, it's a very interesting philosophical question.
Sure, it's like why do humans not all function the same way? Why are we not already robots?
Right. I mean, or if robots have artificial intelligence in them, will they argue between them? Would you have robotic arguments?
Right. Or for instance, so even if it's on different topics, would the robots, even if programmed all the same, eventually democratize in thought?
Right.
Or would we go through a period where they ape and imitate us and then go and say, you know what, screw it, one thought process to rule them all?
Right. I mean, will artificial intelligence eventually grow up? Like, you know, if you tell a child that don't cross a road, you know, look both ways, but then they become teenagers and they say, parents don't know it. I can totally cross streets. Of course, and then you might get hit by a car like me when I was young. So that was actually not so smart.
The other scary aspect of it too is that if an artificial intelligence, and this is, you know, the old Turing test, in all ways is like us, then at what point is it human? And at what point are we it?
Well, that is a very relevant question that we'll eventually cross it. And we will cross it probably in intermediary stages.
Sure. I don't think it's going to be an all-in-one, but I bring it up because it goes back to the critique of Searle, right? That the art AI creates is redundant and replicative. There's no soul or essence to it. And if you argue that Searle, whatever that may be,
But I would like you to go into what you think Searle is, because I know that writers now have suddenly found the issue of Searle to be very important because they are afraid of losing their jobs. So Searle is, and I also know Searle is a type of music.
Yes.
And so I would like you to talk a little bit about what you think Searle means.
So I'm going to share this through the particular first, because I think it speaks to the question of whether or not this is a process of thoughts that an artificial intelligence could replicate without being guided every step of the way, right? If it were generative instead of redundant, instead of repetitive. So I'm working on the epilogue of what will be the third book now.
Let me just make a comment before you go. All modern artificial intelligence is generative, you know. People are no longer doing programming of artificial intelligence. They have huge neural networks that do learning through interaction with some type of data.
I guess I'm trying to find the right way to split this, but functionally that, and partly it's because, you know, you and I are both living through the bridge of these two forms of technology, of these two expressions of the same technology, where we grew up with effectively automaton robots, right? We gave a thing orders, it operated on the orders. We are struggling now with a thing we give, if not a set of Kantian prerogatives to, then a set of axioms to start from and let it learn from them. And that's still not a human being, even though we try to reduce human thought into those things. There's a large crossover between behaviorism and AI, for instance, back when they thought human behavior was fully programmable. And there's still, you know, cadre of psychologists, as you know, that do believe that. But I'll contextualize this as following. I was writing, and this in a way becomes meta. There's a section in book three where you and I were talking about the earliest part of the story. And for those who haven't heard me present this before, when I broke the book down into three books, one of the big decisions I made was that for the first book to have two timelines, now and then, the second book to have three timelines, now, then, and I forget the term for the other time, the third book goes to the actual beginning and the final end that wraps around everything else. So you and I were talking about the way back in the beginning. And I don't think this is a huge spoiler, but there's a scientist in it who has a child that is terminally ill, and he's trying to construct an artificial form or a body to transfer that consciousness of his child into. And I was thinking purely from the medical concerns, but here's the thing that emerged as equally important. Because the child was conscious, he asked them, what do you want your new body to be? Right? If I can create my ideal form, would I choose to or not? That's an interesting question. And then, okay, assuming I choose to and I give my child permission to, and this is a topical thing in the States too. So maybe in all likelihood that has influenced this moment I was thinking. But I think, as I said to you, there were two decisions the child made that their father struggled with. One was that the new body be a different biological sex. And he was fairly accepting of that because the society they lived in at that point, this was no longer an issue in the societies he was engaged with. The bigger issue for him was that the body his child wanted did not represent the ethnicity they were currently. And as you and I were talking about, this was a much older man, had a child late in life, and had a lot of legacy to his culture, his history, his society, as part of a global community now, that he was afraid would be lost in this transfer. And the child is arguing, how is it lost? I'm still your kid. I grew up with you. I'm not devaluing any of the things we learned together. I just want to have what is me. If I have this chance that no one else has, you know, this is my genie wish here, right? You're going to give me the form that I always wanted in all the ways I wanted. So they fought back and forth. Eventually, there's another researcher who takes over the day-to-day, everyday care. And at one point, I'm sitting there writing the logs of communication this researcher has with his child, doing the medical maintenance while the father works on the new body and the transfer of conscious technology and all that. So the researcher up in space keeps sending the father the logs. And they turned into these Aristotelian dialogues. What is death? How do you know my consciousness can actually be transferred? What does it mean to convey all of me? What would be needed for that? You know, I know we've talked about the science of this, but really, how do I know that when you move me to there, all of me goes? And none of this, even if they'd been thematic elements throughout the entire story, had emerged in this expression. And I was as surprised as I've ever been in those moments before, where this became such a salient part of the narrative. And my question, I guess, is, do you think we could get AI to be able to, if not now, then at some point, follow the if-thens and all of the contextual elements to surprise itself with what it finds, and then accept that surprise and keep moving on with it to build from that? Do you think we could create an AI that has a sense of not just wonder, but joy as well?
My answer is yes. That's the short answer. That was an argument that I had a lot with Antonio Damasio, that I always do. He's a great neurologist, great scientist. And it's because he did all his work. That's the guy I work with at University of Southern California, where we met. And so he did all his work. And, you know, a lot of his work, he affirms that somehow these human feelings, these human emotions are unreproducible in a machine. I was the annoying guy that says, this doesn't mean impossible, this means really difficult.
Right, because we've not proven, one, we can't prove that it's impossible, because that's impossible.
And secondly, because all the necessary alterations to go from a machine to a human body, they might represent a huge amount of operations, but they seem to be like a finite amount of operations.
In a way, it goes back to your question of pushing the massive person onto the tracks. At what point does the shift into a non-organic, let's call it, human consciousness become of little enough
effort? But the thing is, the difficulty is confusing artificial and non-organic. Because when you think artificial, we think of a computer, which basically is an electronical system that just moves currents around.
Yes, but so does your brain with other functions.
Right. But the question is, what about a balloon filled with liquids in which the molecules operate and they transport information from one molecule to the next, creating wirings and connections that are invisible to the human eye? Because they are about microfilaments that connect different micromolecules that are in that balloon, and they are creating an artificial balloon of artificial intelligence.
You're painting kind of a thought picture here where if you, say, blow into a balloon, and all of the microbes in your mouth leave your body, colonize the interior of the balloon, which is a contained environment, soar up into the atmosphere, and perpetuate throughout that entire process. At what point have you birthed a new universe in consciousness?
Right. And so it's like, you know, the technology of fusion between machines and humans will make humans be a little bit more machine-like, but it will also push machines into being more biology-like. So it goes both ways. And so where exactly, at what point they will meet? So what will be the exact meeting point? It's a mysterious that only technology will resolve. But Star Trek gives a hint. Star Trek gives a hint.
Going into space.
No, you see, you have the Borg.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You have the Borg where they have, you know, the biological and the machine are fused, but it's mostly machine. Okay. You have the humans that have not fused with technology, but their bodies have been altered so that they survive radiation and negative G's and all that, because otherwise they would just die, okay? And you also have the founders who have developed this drug that enslaves other groups to be the menial tasks, but they have this liquid form, a little bit like Terminator 2, you know, the guy that liquefies.
Right.
So, but they have a community of Terminator 2s, you know, like the guy that liquefies us. So they're a community, they're an ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And then they live as semi-homogeneous, semi-autonomous. So when they decide to leave the ocean, they walk as individuals. But when they go to sleep, they leave the sleep as communities. When they're at peace as communities. It's only when they need to intervene in the world that they become individuals.
You know, it goes back to the man and the butterfly again.
Yes.
At what point are you man dreaming butterfly or butterfly dreaming man?
Right.
And if for instance, we reached a point where we could transfer consciousness freely, is the automaton body you inhabit any less you than the organic one? And I think that's partly a cultural question, because I think that answer will change as we do as a society. The reason I bring up the question of wonder and joy is that if I were to work with an AI in a generative capacity as a writer, it would be to do two things. And I'm not saying this as the writing community on the whole, because I think this is still predicated on, one, solving the quandary of property, right? Which is when these things are created, how do we resolve the fact that the current AIs tap upon what has already existed to supplement or fill its answer out? Whether that's a visual or textual or so on. But provided we can solve that, and that might, to your point, require us having a different cultural approach to property and collectivism and a bunch of other stuff, right?
Right.
Provided we can solve those things, yeah, I could definitely see working with an AI to go, hey, there is so much to this thing I've created that I would have much more, to your friend's point with the coin, capacity to be the creator of, to be the one seeking the joy, delight, surprise, and the act of creation to share, right? If other aspects of this that I don't necessarily have the greatest capacity for. And even if I were to learn them, right? And I say this with all respect to Janet Fitch, the author of White Oleander. We cornered her after class one day and said to Janet, how is it that your pacing, your structure of your books is so exquisite? And her answer was, it's very simple. I suck at it. So I spent years learning how to improve upon it, right? If I could find an AI partner that could collapse those years, right, into dialogue between us, into actual social engagement with another creative entity so that we could do more better.
Right. But I think that's the future. I think that is the future. And I think people will get stuck in doing it the old ways, and people will advance on doing this hybrid and fusion thing. And the fusion thing, I think, will succeed. But of course, you always have the danger of, like, do you remember CGI? When CGI was all the craze, and everything was going to be done in CGI, and everything was going to look great because it was CGI. And you know where all CGI movies are? In the trash bin now, because they all look terrible. They all look incredibly fake. And the ones that actually survive are, like, for instance, the first Transformers movie, because when he wanted to explode something, he put the bomb inside the car, and he exploded it, and he filmed it, and it looks great because it looks like an explosion. But the fake things, you look back, and they look so fake.
You know where CGI works best? Animation. Because it deals with the issue of Uncanny Valley.
Right.
Animation's already
uncanny.
Far enough. Yeah, it's already
enough.
Uncanny.
It's already uncanny. It's already far enough. So you can do whatever you want in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that the problem is that it's very expensive to make CGI that is realistic. And so it's much cheaper to just explode it. Just explode it. You know, you buy a cheap car, you buy a cheap bomb, you put it there, you move away, you put the camera, and you press the button, and it works.
I'll share this with you. I'm reading a book series by Joe Abercrombie, and it goes from, you know, Vikings and swords and sorcery to industrialism. And the wizards that were at the beginning are there at the end in the industrial period too. But at one point, someone asked the 700-plus-year-old wizard, who is an awful bastard that's involved in everything, because honestly, if you're a 700-year-old wizard, there's three things about you. You're awful, you're a bastard, and you're involved in everything because you've had the time and the lack of morals or compunction to not be. They ask him why he doesn't do magic anymore, and he says, it's very simple. I run the banks. Money does everything the magic did. Like, I could sit there, you know, consort with demons, draw energy from the other realm, warp my existence, or I could just blackmail you. Or I could just tell my minions at the bank to issue a loan with horrifying stipulations that you have to pay back or you're forever indebted to me for, and effect the same thing without the cost to myself. You know, it's very cynical, but it's also very human, right? Because you seem to be going...
No, it's very human. Yeah. And one of the things that... There are two issues that you touched upon, which are extremely relevant, which is the issue of ownership.
Yes.
And the issue of privacy. I say privacy. Is it privacy that you're supposed to say?
You know, that is one of those cultural things, like spelling story in terms of tiers of building with an E in it. And you know, I'll read it in a book. It'll drive me mad. I'll hear people say tyranny instead of tyranny. And I will want to say something, but I'm also learning that a lot of telling people how to say things is imperialistic itself. So, you know, language is fluid. If I'm going to argue culture is, I have to accept that pronunciation will change too.
But is it privacy that you're supposed to say? Privacy and tyranny?
I think it's in American English privacy. I cannot say for elsewhere.
I think English is privacy because I've seen actors do it.
Right.
And American English is privacy.
Yeah. It's like when they switch R's and E's and we get mad at them.
Yeah.
Even though functionally the word sounds the same.
But this British guy is always speaking English the wrong way.
Right. Where did they learn to? Never you mind that you see these actors speaking Shakespeare in English as it was at the time. And it sounds almost incomprehensible.
You know what's the true accent? It's actually funny because what they write English, the way they speak English, they try to use it in kind of King James Bible style.
Right.
But that's not the right style of Shakespeare, because Shakespeare is about one generation before the King James Bible, because Shakespeare worked for the aunt of King James.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one generation before, and Shakespeare sounded Scottish. Actually, the actual pronunciation is a bit very strong to Northern Scotland.
Okay, because I've heard a thick brogue when language scholars have tried to read Shakespeare in what they believe was the way he would guide actors to perform.
It's similar. And the rhymes work better in Scottish than in any other language. It's not exactly modern Scottish, but if you listen to it, it will sound to you like the accent from Scotland.
Interesting.
Because the thing is that I think French has, how do you say, franchised a lot, became more French-like afterwards.
I think when you create an institution dedicated to the preservation of your language, and I'm not denigrating the act per se, although there are definitely issues with how it works. But I think when you do that, you attempt to edify a thing that is, or you attempt to reify a thing, rather, that is fluid.
Right. But the thing is that, the thing interesting about Shakespeare is that they froze it at the wrong time. They froze it one generation later. If you go back, I mean, that's what I read. I'm not an expert on Shakespeare. I've read a little bit about those experts in Shakespeare. And if you look at the way it rhymes really well, because he has a lot of rhymes that don't work in English or in King James Bible English, but it works really well with a slightly Scottish accent. And it was a lot more, the rhythm of it was more like a bar brawl than high intellectuality. You know, you have to imagine a mob that is probably a little bit touched with something, that is yelling and screaming and laughing and interacting with the dynamics of what's happening on stage. It's not the...
It's the public storyteller's audience instead of the performer at the court.
Yes.
I was actually thinking this earlier, but it's come back to me now, talking about the idea of legacy. When stories are told, whether it's the Bible, whether it's what I write or you write or anyone else, firstly, the audience hears them however they as individuals hear them, which won't be how you tell or think it should be told. There will be overlap, but they'll never be complete, right? That system is, by nature of being, you're broad enough, it cannot be complete. That's the when you write a story, you have to leave it open enough for others to put themselves into it, because as I've argued, it only comes to life in that moment. But I could see, as a notion of legacy, what if, for instance, you know, half jokingly I said before, we could give Cervantes a chance to redo the Bible, not rewrite or anything, but just perform it, say it, show it differently. What would it elucidate or illuminate that we have ignored because a different instrument plays it? What if...
I think he would make us laugh.
I think he would, because simply the constant argument of, we were all there, how do we not agree on what happened?
I think you'll make us laugh. I like the Monty Python's retelling of Josephus.
Yes.
Yeah, you know which movie I'm talking about, right?
Is this The Life of Brian or is this?
Life of Brian. In the beginning of The Life of Brian, it says, based on historical writings of Josephus, we proceed to follow to tell this story. And that's the beginning of it.
Right.
But actually, if you read Josephus, yeah, they're right. This is absolutely Josephus. You know, the terrorist group of the liberation of Judea that is fighting the movement for the true liberation of Judea.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
That's from Josephus.
Yeah.
That kind of infighting and messy and complicated, and everybody's saying one thing, and you know the thing of, well, what have the Romans did for us? The roads? Yes, but besides the roads, what have they done for us? The aqueduct? Yes, of course, that goes without saying. But besides the roads and the aqueduct, what have they done for us? Public gardens? Yes, but besides the roads, the aqueduct, and the public gardens, what have they done? This is, yes, agriculture? Yes, but besides it. And because Josephus is actually Josephus, the story of Josephus, and if you like, if you it's mind-bogglingly and tremendously interesting, because he's a guy that starts his story by being sent to Rome with a group to complain about a certain governor that is not doing the right thing.
He's picketing, or he's a protester. Yeah.
Yeah. Then he goes back, and so the Rome eventually changes that guy, puts another guy. Sure. Then the locals decide it's the right time to revolt.
Right guy in place, don't like the government anyway.
Yeah. It tries to explain to them that that's a really bad idea. Uh-huh. That's a really terrible idea. Okay, but they don't listen to him. They revolt. Once they revolt, they decide to call him again to be one of the leaders of the towns of the revolution to which he was against. And he accepts.
Sure.
So he goes. And then he's fighting, and he's effectively fighting against the Roman army. The Roman army gets tired and decides to slaughter all of them. They decide they're going to, you know, commit suicide. Mm-hmm. But he says, this is not right. It's not right for you to take your own life, but you can ask your friends to take your life for you.
Okay.
But you have to draw lots. Then by some coincidence, the only guy that survived is him and another guy. Then he is captured by the general. And the first thing he sees is that God has come to talk with them, and that the prophecy of the Messiah, that of course Christians believe it was Jesus, but he says, no, mm-hmm. It was not Jesus. It was Vespasian. So have you not heard of the Messiah Vespasian? Well, to Josephus, Vespasian was the true Messiah because he was conquering the world and all that. And he says, you are the true Messiah and you will become emperor. Vespasian just laughed because he was old. Nero was in charge. He was not of the family. Nero was young. This was just stupid. Well, Nero commits suicide in order to not be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
There was a huge mess. Like Romans usually do, they kill a lot of each other.
Sure.
And there's only basically one important guy that is still alive. He's the general that is fighting in Judea, which is General Vespasian.
Yep.
So they bring him to be emperor. And he says, well, this guy might know something. And he lives in with his son, Tito.
Mm-hmm.
And Tito becomes his friend. He says, okay, my father seems to like me. Okay, we're going to hire you. Why don't you write the story of your people that, you know, we're just destroying them. So might as well write their story so that at least there's a record of it. And so then he writes the history of the Jews. That's when he starts writing the history of the Jews. And then he writes, and he keeps on writing because Tito then becomes emperor and brings him to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
He tries again and again to tell his contemporaries that he's not a traitor, that he's not a sellout, that he actually has the best interests of Jews at heart. There is not one single Jew in Judea that believes in him.
You know, I was joking initially when I said I can see Cervantes writing this, but there's an element of farce to this.
Right. And so he writes the history of the Jews, and actually he's the only historian of the time of Jesus.
Because the rest were after.
Because the rest were either destroyed or burned, because the Rome was destroyed several times. Okay.
Right.
And he was not important to the Romans. You see, for the Romans at the time, Jesus was nothing. See, I mean, he is some revolutionary guy that was saying things and he got killed. You know how many thousands they did like that?
Many.
But he was important. It was important in the history of the Jews, but not because of Jesus, but because Jesus was the brother of James.
Right. You brought up something during this that I think dovetails back to our conversation, which was the decision of what persists, right? For the longest time, and this is where writing and the printing press became revolutionary. They altered what was preserved and by whom and who created in the first place.
Right.
So we are in this weird environment now where the technology feeds off of what exists to function. And that may be how it works in its nascent phase in order to grow enough to become something more. The hope is that it doesn't stay there and shouldn't stay there, right? But I wonder if there's a certain possibility where, due to the nature of the internet, all of these attempts, these thought processes, exercises, efforts, etc., the log not just of the thing that is created and edited and curated, but the work that led to it exists as well. I don't think it's this generation of AI yet, but I think we're going to reach a point where, let's say I have an AI partner or we have an AI that writes a book. Because of the way they operate, it is possible to keep a log of everything it did to write the book in every iteration, so that once the book, the story, et cetera, is out there, so is the entire effort involved in creating it. I can do that as a writer too, right?
Right.
But the amount of work involved in documenting it is additional effort, whereas the actual process itself creates its record.
You know what I think is the problem of artificial intelligence?
What?
It spends too much energy. If you look at the energy we spend as living beings to have this amazing machine working at the top of our shoulders, and the amount of energy that it requires for a supercomputer to run.
So human body, 2,000 average calories a day to function.
Yeah, it's a little bit of chemical product.
Right. How much is that AI taking? Like, we haven't even gone into the environmental, you know, complications of it. But yeah, how much energy is one AI like ChatGPT consuming?
I know it's enough for Bitcoins to be a problem.
Yeah, Bitcoins have already created environment. I forget the rubric, but there are certain Bitcoin economies that create more pollution now than countries.
Right. And the thing is that this machine is nothing compared to you in terms of computation.
Right. So that's why I use the word nascent, because we're at a point now where effectively we're feeding more into the thing than it gives.
But no, that will not always be the case. There's the most advanced ones. You know, there's guys that you say, this guy is not really. Henry Kissinger.
Sure.
The guy is, I don't know, 90? And he decides, I'm going to write a book about artificial intelligence because I don't quite understand it. And it's one of the most impactful books that have sold all across the world because it's the most interesting book about artificial intelligence.
Right, because it's not about business profits.
No, it's a guy, he has friends that he likes to talk about these things. Of course, his friend is like the director of artificial intelligence for MIT, the owner of the, I don't know, of the largest California department of something for artificial intelligence. And so he has this, while there was COVID happening, he was having these conversations with these guys. And then he asked his secretary to transcribe them a little bit so that he can read it and think about it. And the secretary was just amazing because she couldn't stop reading. She couldn't stop reading it because it was just amazing what those guys were discussing and the way they were explaining and the way they were thinking about it. And so people started, and so people wanted to start to join in because this guy, Henry Kissinger, says, I don't know anything about artificial intelligence. And so there are a couple of things I don't understand. And then he makes a question and you have the guys on the other side and they were silent.
Because it was one they had assumed was answered and didn't bother to think of.
And it was like, I never thought about that, said the other guy.
Right.
And the question to Henry Kissinger, he says, okay, so we have artificial intelligence and our enemies have artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
How can you measure if their artificial intelligence will destroy our artificial intelligence or not? How can you be sure?
We can't even measure our own intelligence accurately.
That's where the discussion starts.
Yeah.
It says we have no idea. We don't know. And the entire book is about that.
Starts from there. I want to, this came up to me as you were talking, two questions. And they lead to the same way. We're talking about soul before.
Right.
First question, do you think AI, if it reached the point beyond just calling what exists into communicating with each other, could reach that same level of discovery where in talking with other intelligences that have other expertise, they issue queries to each other and go, oh, that is a thought I've never had before. I use the word I here loosely. But where does that lead me now that enriches my understanding of how to do and think about things? And likewise, I think the question that leapt to me from there is, what if soul isn't internal, but something that only exists in the in-between, right? We often talk about soul as a thing that leaves our body when we pass on and is the immortal part of us. But what if the thing that in part makes us human is that thing that only exists in the moment of interaction between each other? There's a co-creation of it.
Okay. Let me tell you, I'll go to this answer, but let me first answer two questions that were left behind and not quite finished. First,
sure.
Ownership. I think the future of ownership is you have to have enough capacity of ownership so that it is worth your time, your investment, and your effort. So if something requires time, effort, and risk, the reward to the person putting the effort, the time, and the risk has to be big enough so that the effort, the time, and the risk are worth it. So ownership is essential. Otherwise, people will stop risking, they'll stop efforting, and they'll stop creating. Okay?
You have to provide what they want out of the thing they're creating somehow.
Somehow. So you have to somehow give it back.
Okay? Yes. There has to be remuneration.
Right. Now, privacy. Now, privacy.
Or more accurately, reciprocity. Let's call it that. Go ahead.
Okay. Now for privacy. A little British. The privacy. Now for privacy. Okay. What I think is the need for privacy is the following. We have to decide where our soul is.
Yes.
That is the key issue of the privacy. It's like an issue of a community. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about Calvinists, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, they consider, if I might be exaggerating, but privacy to be a sin or to be the source of sin. So you only want privacy because you're going to do something that is wrong to God or that is wrong to your fellow man. Because if you're doing things that are right to God and to your fellow man, you have no need for privacy.
Sure.
Okay. So that's Calvinism. And now goes back to the internet now, to the issue of privacy is that, and to the issue of ownership, except if you want ownership. Because if you want ownership, part of the ownership is on the way of doing it. Mm-hmm. So if you have ownership, you must have secrets to your fellow man, because it's not that just so much that you're doing something harmful to your fellow man, is that you're trying to keep something good for yourself more than to your fellow man. So you're not doing them harm, you're just blocking the flow of good to your fellow man because you deserve it more, because you have worked harder for it. So the issue of ownership links with the issue of privacy.
You would need an entire different structure of reciprocity where the needs were met external to the work you did, or the needs were met in a system outside of the work you did.
Yes.
So that the work you did was the work you did for perhaps internal, you know, purpose reasons as opposed to subsistence reasons. And this is, you know, this is an issue the creative communities always fall with, because as you mentioned earlier, most creators are poor or low income or median income. It's rare that you find a creator that is wealthy, but the value of the work they do is also incredibly difficult to estimate outside of certain financial parameters. So, you know, we have, for instance, things like Patreon now, where communities can go and agree upon a set value for the work given to them, whatever it is, and support directly the creators. But part of that exists specifically because the ecosystem and economics that predated it did not allow for that money to get to the creators who could use it, right?
Right. And who is a creator and who is a hangaround?
And AI partly blurs that line, because I can go take a thing, I can go take a style of a thing you created on, say, Patreon, and all those kind of genre tags, et cetera. And I, or intentionally or not, I can type in genre, individuals, tones, themes, colors, etc. And intentionally or not, it could go crib from that public image of a thing you've posted for a private community that they give you money for, and draw upon aesthetic elements wholesale or individually to generate my artificial image.
Mm-hmm. Right. But the problem is, this is the problem, the intrinsic problem of value, is that, and I write this on the book, is that the problem of value, it is a social construction in the sense that it depends on the perceived needs of the society. Of course, there are permanent perceived needs, like the need for water, the need for food, the need for friendship, okay? Those are permanent perceived needs, okay?
Right. Currency is a construct.
Even for the need of friendship, there are exceptions. Like, I remember Stalin's phrase, if I want loyalty, I buy a dog.
You're entirely wrong.
Just like, but okay, so these are the ownership and privacy issues, okay? And so I think what I was trying to affirm here is that privacy and ownership go together, and we might need to rethink all the issue of privacy in the sense that if being in the web means the removal of privacy to have access to this world, if it's the disintegration of privacy that is the future, this is not new in the sense that in several religious traditions, including the Calvinists, privacy was the seed of evil.
Well, it's, I think, to paraphrase from some of the Buddhist traditions, it's the illusion of self.
Right. Now you nailed it. Now you've nailed it. That's the issue. It's like when you talk about the soul, like that thing that goes into the heaven, but that it is us, not the spirit. The spirit is diffused. It is all around, okay? Mm-hmm. But the soul is ours, okay? And it is eternal, okay? But is this just ego?
Well, and that's like if you go through those texts saying that something that a creative noumen or apron or whatever term you want to have it, that an existence predated you, becomes you, leaves the you that is you to return to whatever it was. If, you know, to quote Rumi, if the drop in the ocean thinks it's a drop in the ocean until it sees all the other drops that are the waves around it, paraphrase, I suppose, but, you know, that you, the sense of you is a social construct itself.
Yes and no. Yes and no. Why I say yes and no? Because it is a social construct, but if you go across different societies, it's not like you find people that don't know that they have a self. You know, you don't come across society and say, me? Is there a me? I didn't know there was a me.
My other part of it was that it's bound to our biology. Because part of growing from infancy to adulthood and on is recognizing similarity, difference. What is the beginning or end of my physicality? At what point do I need things that is different from others? Like, recognizing all the boundaries that comprise a you, right? That's part of emerging as a human being.
You know the hero myth, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that the hero myth is passé now that we have woke, and Disney is going bankrupt with all the woke films that it is made? You know, you've heard of the rumor that Apple is buying Disney?
It's not going to change Disney if it does.
But this is relevant because it has to do with the thing. I talked about the hero myth and the issue of the soul and the issue of the self.
Right.
And this connects to your work, to your book of the child that wanted, you know, they wanted to have a different gender than the... It's funny because she's picking a new body. So she's picking a new body that is different from the old body. So the psychology is the same, but now she wants a different body with a different gender and a different ethnic group.
Yes.
And the father says, oh, it's fine that you have a different gender, but it's, you're going too far, a different ethnic group.
You're becoming a different you that I don't approve of.
Yeah. So where is the you? I mean, is the you because, okay, I have a female body, but I have a male psychology, or but I was born Jewish, but I actually want to be Irish, okay? What is the biological self?
Mm-hmm. What is the cultural self? Yeah.
And what is the dialogue between the two?
Right, assuming there's a spiritual self as well, yeah. I always think back to what Ray Bradbury said, which is that man is the flesh of God moving through the universe. And it's an open-ended statement, because fundamentally, at root, what he's saying is you have an omnipotent existence that still, at some level, chooses to become a limited thing. When I was saying you here, I meant the universal. So I should say there is according to the statement Bradbury gave, there is a universal omnipotent being that chooses, or if not chooses, that as part of its existence also manifest in limited fashion, becomes a small thing that has full control, or at least most control, over a small space, right? And then exist in a universe, a set of parameters for a period of whenever. And whether it's a choice that that thing does it or not, or just a fact of its existence, we'll never know, because fundamentally, according to this architecture Bradbury has established, we're just the fingers on the hand, the drop in the water. And the reason that whole scientist situation emerged was that he eventually uses that technology in my book of trying to create a new body for his child to give something greater than human existence, an AI, let's call it, a thing that is as close to man as it could be so that it can better understand man. And he creates a whole group of these for it to inhabit.
I'm answering your question about the soul. I'm going to give you like just a short resume of what we know about information in science, okay?
Good.
Okay, this is resume. Most of the concept of information is based on the Shannon concept of information, Shannon information.
Right.
Which is generic. It has nothing to do with the content. It has to do with the capacity of having a contact that a certain set of symbols can have. So if the set of symbols is just A all throughout the lines, there's nothing complicated that you can put in it. Okay? So you have to have a variety of symbols.
Right. So you have the container and what can fit into it.
But you have to have a variety of symbols. So you have to have different symbols with different rhythms and different frequencies. And those frequencies of those symbols give you an idea of the amount of information in the message.
Right. So the more variable that is, the more information you can convey. Okay.
So I'm going to give you an exact number. Imagine that you have a probability P of a symbol.
Right.
That probability goes between 0 and 1. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you have the inverse of P, which is 1 over P, which is the frequency of this. And then you make the logarithm of that value, okay? That's the Shannon information. The Shannon information is the logarithm of the inverse of a probability. The basis of that logarithm, which means where you're projecting the logarithm, is how many symbols you have, okay?
Right.
So you have a number. Given if you have two symbols, like zeros and ones, and you have a probability of 0.15, something like that, then 1 over 0.15 is 8, more or less. And if you have 8, then the log base 2 of 8 is 3, which means that to represent this kind of things, you need 3 bits, okay? To represent something that is...
Done. So 3 entries in the system, complete.
Because you'd need to have 8 different states.
Yeah.
And so that one of the states is that one that you picked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's the concept of Shannon information. Okay. And it's applied all over physics. If you go at the most fundamental level, which is quantum field theory, and so I'm going to go to you the most fundamental level all the way to computers. Okay. Because, all right.
Sure.
At the most fundamental level, what you have at the beginning is a vacuum that is like profound chaos. Okay.
Everything back to entropy.
Yeah. And you have these quantum fields, which have these things that are both particle and wave. And this is like, they are waves, but they can generate particles. Okay?
Right. It's to use the analog, let's say going back to if we have tohu wabohu, which is the chaos state, or just in Greek, chaos.
Yeah.
Then you have the pre-state, which is existence of energy or substance without form.
Right. Without
form. Purpose.
Yeah. Without purpose. And then these forms, okay, each particle that you know of, like an electron, mm-hmm. is a quanta of one of those quantum fields.
Drop in the waves.
Yep. Like a drop in the ocean. But it's a drop that comes out of the ocean, okay, then goes back to the ocean. Okay?
It's a raindrop in and out
it's
of the ocean.
It's a raindrop and yeah. in and out, okay. And then you have an ocean of electrons, and then you have an ocean for each type of quark, and you have an ocean for each type of neutrinos.
And they're not layered like a cake, they're just
interlaced. They just alter it. And so you have actually 12 types of fields.
Based upon the particles we know now.
Yes. And I have reasons to believe that there are reasons to believe that this is it. The reason why is it for the things to balance, they have to be a certain number. So if there is more, things got out of balance, okay? Then they're starting canceling each other, and the whole thing breaks apart.
It's funny, because I think a lot of the base mathematics systems we went before the current one were 12-base, right?
Well, yes, 12 seems to be a system that appears a lot. And I would not go, now I'm going to go through the physics, and
sure.
But it's interesting to think about this. Okay, so they are divided in three groups of four. Okay, a four is a family, which is made of a quark with the opposite charge, a neutrino, and an electron. And the two quarks of this first family are the up quark and the down quark. And the up quark and the down quark are what constitutes the proton and the neutron. The proton is two ups and one down. The neutron is one up and two down quarks. So they are triplet. And the reason why they form in triplets is because just like there's electric charge, at the strong nuclear forces level, there are three different types of electric charge. It's called the red electric charge, the blue electric charge, and the green electric charge.
I'm glad our childhood building blocks still inform our science.
Okay. But now there's a thing that is interesting. In electrical charge, there's only one way of making neutral charges, which is one positive and a negative, right?
Sure.
For strong nuclear forces, you have that. So you have a red and an anti-red, for example. Mm-hmm. But you have another way, which is make a red, the green, and the blue, which makes white.
It's a full dynamic.
Right. So that's a triplet. And so hadrons, like protons and neutrons, hadrons is a group of particles, of which proton and neutron are two examples. Okay, protons and hadrons and neutrons are hadrons. It means every very heavy stuff. So those are the particles, protons and neutrons, that constitute the nucleus of an atom.
Mm-hmm.
An electron is what goes around it, okay? But the thing is, if a neutron can transform into a proton, and it sends two things out, it sends one electron and one neutrino, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where neutrinos come from that process, okay? That's where
right, it's a transformation. Nothing is lost, it's just changing shape.
And when neutrinos and the quarks interact, they don't interact through the strong nuclear force. They interact through the weak nuclear force, which is a slightly weaker one. Okay.
Right.
So you have three fundamental forces: strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, and electromagnetic force.
And that allows for things to not stay always the same, because if you could not break if you could not break into the neutrino level, you would get no new atoms.
Right. And curiously enough, they are all caused by an invariance on the phase. Imagine the clock, okay?
Right.
Of the wave that represents the particles. If it's a one-dimensional invariance, then it's the electromagnetic force. If it's a two-dimensional invariance, then it's the weak nuclear force. And if it's a three-dimensional invariance, then it's the strong nuclear force. And that's it.
And so fundamentally, even though the early state was chaos and the state after is substance, the substance is impermanent.
Right.
Or the amount of substance remains, but its state changes.
Right. And now they still don't have mass, because they are quantum particles moving at the speed of light. For them to have mass, you need the Higgs mechanism. And for the Higgs mechanism, you need the Higgs particle. Now, and so what the Higgs mechanism does is that it defines a kind of a universe of Higgs particles, like a sea of Higgs, and the particles, through their interaction with the Higgs particles, they slow down, they lazy down, and they gain a mass.
So effectively, you create a society of particles that cluster together.
Right.
And communicate within each other, share, transfer, but by and large don't disintegrate back into the greater mass.
Right.
And the greater sink.
Okay. And so this, but there's a difference, is that all the gauge particles, see, the Higgs particle is like the photon. The photon is a particle of the electromagnetic force, is the carrier of the electromagnetic force.
Mm-hmm.
The carrier of the strong nuclear force are gluons. Okay. And the Higgs particle are the carrier of the Higgs field. Okay, The carriers of the weak nuclear force are a triplet called the massive vector bosons. Okay, but that doesn't matter. But there are three, the W plus, the W minus, and the Z zero. And the thing is that at the beginning, at the Big Bang, when everything was going on, all these forces had such tremendous energy that they had all the same behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But as the energy reduces, because the universe inflates, they start segregating into groups, okay?
So effectively, the amount of potential or possibilities reduces as they diversify.
Yes. And now, and as energies cool down and they diversify, then you can start to have protons, then you can start to have electrons, and then you can start to have atoms, and then you can start to have stars, and then you can start to have galaxies, and so forth. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, throughout all this, there's space-time, okay? And there's the energy of space-time that if the energy is strong enough, it curves it, and it creates the illusion of gravity.
In a sense, there's space-time creates a field isn't the right word, but space-time defines the sea in which all this happens and changes the parameters of the sea, which then force or separate everything accordingly.
Right.
As it fluctuates.
Right. And this is the standard model. This is not my pet theory or my paper. Yes. This is just overall the standard model or contemporary standard model.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have this, and now you have all these things going, and then you go into quantum mechanics. Okay, quantum mechanics is one step above that. In quantum mechanics, the strong nuclear forces and the weak nuclear forces are stuck together in the nucleus of the atom. And all they do is that they create mass to the nucleus of the atom. Because the mass of the proton is not provided by the mass of the quarks. It's provided by the energy of the quarks using the Einstein equations E equals mc squared.
Right.
Which actually the original equation of Einstein was not E equals mc squared. He was not the first one to write this. Someone else did. His first equation was m equals e divided by c squared. Because what he wanted to show was that mass can transform into energy.
Yes.
So he calculated the amount of...
Well, I think because that's the more observable phenomenon, right?
Yeah.
You start a car, your fuel turns into energy that you use to propel the car.
And so you ask, how much mass does it change? What is the mass change caused by the import
because
of energy?
We are oriented toward mass first, since we mostly perceive mass.
Right. So you wanted to calculate the mass, not the energy. So he didn't write E equals mc squared. He wrote m equals e divided by c squared.
But the structure of E equal mc squared suggests that energy is the universal. It's the thing that we all are, despite what we perceive.
That's because later on, as special relativity and general relativity were developed also by Einstein, it started to become clear that what is fundamental is not the mass, it's the energy. And so the focus moved. This was just cultural. The equation is the same, but this was just cultural. The focus moved from the mass to the energy.
The waves don't matter. The fact that we're all water is the truth.
Yes.
To play off of the analogy we've been working on here.
Yes. And then basically you have atoms and you have the electrons around, and that's all chemistry.
Right.
All chemistry is the behavior of electrons around the nucleuses. And so once you have that, then you have molecules and you have things like the crystal called DNA.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically where the information about the construction of human beings is stored. Of course, that's part of the information, because part of the information is also stored into all the engines around the DNA that allow you to read the DNA and to transform DNA into messenger RNA and all these things. So there's all this chemical mechanism.
It's the math of a body, of a living being.
Right, it's the math of the body. And then there's the mitochondria and how the mitochondria influences the DNA by providing energy. Recently, it was found that we are all Asgardians.
In the sense that
we all came from a single cell that was from the line of the type called Asgardians, which is a type of the tree of life. There's a group that they call the Asgardians, which is a group of cells, of primordial cells. and we belong to those groups. So we all, it says, we knew that we evolved from some cell, like all animals, but we did not know from which cell we had evolved from. And they finally, seems that they figured it out now. And it was an Asgardian cell.
It's why humans are animals as opposed to fungi or something else.
Yes, yes, yeah. And so this is basically what the conversions that they found.
Okay.
But now you have this information in the DNA and also stored in the cell. So that's an information that is constantly assessed in the functioning of cells. You see, although the DNA is stable, what part of the DNA is revealed so that it creates proteins? And so it changes.
And the experience of the living being changes how the DNA expresses over time or changes.
Yes, it expresses over time. So yeah, it's permanent, the information there, but it's not permanent what part of it is accessed.
Right. To use a parallel here, you take a human being is a cup out of the ocean. The water inside is the individual human being, but you don't necessarily pour all of it out or exchange all of it in a given moment.
You can also use the parallel of the books behind you. You can have a huge library, but what matters is the books you actually read.
Yes, because the rest of that is just a thing there.
Is that the thing there? So, but when you pass on your generations, you also pass the thing that is just there.
It's the estate. Everything that was you, that was the people before you, still moves on by and large.
Yeah, when you somebody inherits, he inherits all of your books, and they don't know which one you read necessarily.
But it's none of that's the soul yet, and none of it's consciousness either.
Okay, but I'm getting there. Okay, see, that's how tricky it is. Now you have information that the DNA that is transmitted to the surface of each cell, so that when the cell communicates with other cells, it identifies the DNA of the other cell, so to know if that cell belongs to your body or if it's an enemy. And if it's an enemy, they call the army, which are the T cells, to go destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a community. So you have a cell in your body, you have a community.
Well, you have a literal biological and social culture in you.
Yeah, so right, because you have literature, which is your DNA, and you have shared literature, and you don't share all of it. You just said segment. You say, hey, have you read Anna Karenina? And he says, Anna who? Kill it.
There's a certain amount of shibboleths that occur between cells to go, okay, do you know the password? No, bye.
Bye. and so that's the information at the level of the cell. Now, there are special cells called neurons, okay, that have a different thing, that they have disconnectors. So they have this, as I just said, there's different types of cells called neurons that are equal to other cells, but they have these long branches with separations and that they connect, which means that they gain a sense of space, okay? They don't exist just locally, so they are connected. They're connected to the Wi-Fi. So they enter the web. So they have the web.
Effectively, they're a transistor.
Essentially, they are a transistor, but you can also think they have too much information to be a transistor because the information in DNA is like a CD-ROM of information. So it's a lot.
Right. It's almost a subconsciousness.
Right. So you have this information, and you have this network, and then you have information also on the way the connection occurs. But now recent data seems to indicate that actually the actual connection of the white matter is not really that important. And the thing is that because we came from the tradition of the electronic circuits of the motherboards, and that in which the way the wires are connected are very important. But it seems that our brain, that's not the way it actually works. It's more like each motherboard is like a general tool, you know? It's like a neural network. It's more like a neural network, like a general tool. Everything is connected to everything or mostly. And it's the patterns of oscillations.
The patterns and the set pathways for a given process that matter more than the material and that holds space for it.
Yes, yes.
It's a canvas.
It's a canvas.
You don't buy a painting to look at the canvas. You buy a painting to look at what's put on it.
Right. Of course, there might be canvases that are a little bit better than other canvases because the tissue is better, the network, the tension, all this, the quality of absorption is better. But you don't buy something for the canvas. You buy it for the painting that is stored on top of it.
Picasso used to leave pieces on napkins that became fortunes.
Yes. And then, and so now you have this this oscillation pattern, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And now that you have this oscillation pattern, you have to think, so now you have regions and you have patterns of oscillation that go from bottom to top, from top to bottom. And so they are like patterns of working in some regions of working together. We don't know quite, this is this year. This article came out this year. So this is new stuff. We don't know exactly what it means. Okay.
Okay.
But it means that probably for the last 30 years, we've been looking it wrong, how the brain actually works. Just, it means, you know, it's really, really like this. The thing is now you have neurons that are connected to other neurons, and then they work together, they assess neighboring neurons. The energy storage mechanism of the neurons is provided by glial cells that surround them, which basically preserve and make sure that they have the necessary nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
But if a neuron doesn't work all that well, they just stop giving them nutrients.
Right, and the body remaps.
And the body remaps. And so basically, this is the information you have in your body. And then, of course, then then how does wording appears? Then you have like Wernicke's area receives words, then blah, blah, blah. Then you make a little bit in the frontal lobe, you make a little planning, then it goes to Broca, and then you send it. But then there are things like, for instance, we have a type of edge computing which allow us to catch objects that are just flying by very quickly. And you don't have enough time to make your brain organize this. So what your brain does, it says, object there, go grab. And that's about all it says. And the rest of the processing seems to be done by your spinal cord.
Once you can feel it and hold it and look at it, then you figure out what it is. But first is, do I catch it or dodge it?
It just goes, go catch it. And then it liberates the mechanisms of training that you have of dozens of years of catching things, especially if you play baseball.
Mm-hmm.
It goes and grabs it. There's no rationality. There's no thinking. There's just a click, like grab it, and you grab it.
Right. Proprioception, our sense of where we are in space and how to move around that. I've heard, and this is an argument I heard about a decade or more ago, maybe 20 years now. It was a question then of, you know, if artificial intelligence became bodied, if it was a silica life form instead, whether it would experience the world the way we do.
Right. And let me tell you again, I work Damasio's work, because Damasio's work, he's a fantastic neuroscientist. We disagreed in points, in special points, but I admire him tremendously. And the thing he did is that he's very interested in emotions and in organizing the structures of emotions.
Right.
And what are the difference between emotions and feelings. And that's very important, because emotions are simply something that happens in your body. So it's a preparation of your body for events that have already happened and that you're trying to compensate, or that will happen, and that you're trying to prepare your body for the events that will come.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a process of dealing with a situation using your body, okay? Instead of using your rationality or your...
Which is why emotional pain feels like physical pain.
Because it is physical pain.
Because it causes the same harm if it persists.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the thing is that the wrong thing about thinking about the humans, it's a thinking that we have a brain in our head. We have a brain in our head. We have a brain in our stomach. We have a brain in our liver. We have a brain in our cerebellum. And we have a brain throughout our skin. All these are neural systems that are integrated. All these are thinking and integrating and processing information. So when something happens, it doesn't happen in your head. It can be happening in different parts of your body, and it might be processed by different neural structures in the different parts of your body. Of course, the big neuronal structure is your head, but the stomach one is pretty big, and it has to do with dealing with all the digestive system and also distinguish between bad food and good food. And what it should digest and what shouldn't digest and what things should wait, what things should be...
Right. So in summary, the self is, the notion of self is biologically a composite, is neurologically already a composite entity.
Oh, and you have a brain in your heart too. Forgot that.
Sure, because that is its own set of functionalities that needs to be autonomous.
Yes.
The reason I bring this up in part, when I teach storytelling, one of the most, we'll call it, you know, nuclear elements of it is the composition of the scene. And I use the phrase the heart of the scene. It's the beat that everything flows to or follows from. And it takes work to recognize it. It's sometimes an explicitly stated thing. It's sometimes something only subtext leans to. I occasionally make it in a piece of writing for narrative purposes or pacing, et cetera, obvious because it's necessary for, you know, to hit the hammer on the head. But as to what belongs in a scene or doesn't, as to what belongs in a chapter or doesn't, belongs in the story or not, all of those derive from recognizing that core driving beat. And if you can identify the heart of a scene, and I'll use the first two of the book opening in the first chapter, two scenes, I won't even go into details. The two arts of the scene are, or the other scenes are, I wish that things would stay the same. That's scene one. Scene two, they never will be. And that subtext throughout the entirety of both scenes is never explicitly stated, although for narrative purposes I do, because there's other reasons why I put this that language there to build up other motifs. But it made it very simple to understand what belongs in this moment and what doesn't. What is this individual autonomous experience versus the one that follows it? Because scenes in and of themselves are lived experiences or stories that we then assemble into a greater narrative. In the same way that, as a Peter Bispiegel argued in The Last Unicorn, when this is toward the very end, they've defeated the evil king, and the Red Bull has been driven back into the sea, melted away. And one of the characters asked who the wizard Schmendrick, do you think the princess and Almathea, the unicorn turned into human, will have a happy ending? And he goes, no. Schmendrick says, no, of course not. And she's appalled. And she says, how could you think that? He goes, there are no happy endings because there are no endings. That we create stories, we create cells, and attach those things together, because they allow us to make sense of everything we experience and build a system that we can operate in and with.
One of the things that that in my theory of neurons, and although it's not my theory in the sense that I created, but it's just my theory in the sense that I really liked it and I really promote it. And it's, I mean, it's a little bit mine in the sense that the way exactly that I think about it is mine, but it's not that other people have not thought it similarly. Is the idea of that neurons are prophets.
That they make a prediction, send a signal, and wait for the result.
No, more than that. That their survival depends on their prophecies being accurate or not.
Okay, so this goes back to the quantum computing, depending on if your predictions are accurate, the overmind keeps you alive.
Yes.
By sending you sustenance. If your predictions are bad, the overmind goes, you suck, and bye.
Right, yes. And so basically, neurons, you know, have this glial cell surrounding them that gives them nutrients.
Sure.
And if the glial cells say, you know, this guy is always failing, and the neighbors don't like him because you're always giving them wrong information. Yeah, no more food for you. Sorry.
Right, and the body will reabsorb that and apply that. Yeah.
Reabsorb it and use another neuron. And that's learning, you know, that's learning, you know, this neuron just keeps sending wrong prophecies. And if the neuron keeps sending correct prophecies, they should give them food and protect it and try to keep it eternal. Because who wouldn't want to have a prophet that always gets it right around?
Right, that becomes your vizier at that point.
Yeah, that becomes your vizier. Now, he knows, like, so basically the idea of neurons as, you know, of this prophet is that our entire neuronal system is about prophecy. So when humans say they are not religious, I mean, it's impossible because everybody wants to be a prophet.
In a sense, we're always acting, I'm going to say this differently, the way my coach would say it. She likes to talk about fear, and I think it was an acrostic she would break it down to. I might screw it up, but something to the effect is fear is expectation that we assume for reality.
Yes.
Or something like that. Yes. But effectively, we, through the agglomeration of everything our body knows and doesn't know and subsumes and prophesies, whatever language you want to use, comes to a series of decisions, and out of that a narrative assembles, and you act on that, whether it is true or not, in the hopes that either will or won't be.
I'm go there, but I make it a little twist, is that we are intrinsically prophets because we have like this crowd of prophet neurons telling us, each one saying what the future is going to be, okay? But they disagree. So different neuronal populations make different predictions. They claim different things about what the future might come, okay? And then through culture, through learning, through your practices, through your characteristics, there is a certain group of the population that you favor. So you select your prophets, okay?
And then as they get more and more support, to paraphrase, they become more and more favored, another way to say it, the more you lean on them to make further predictions, whether or not they will be accurate in other environments or arenas.
Right. And if they are not accurate, the consequences is your death.
The thing I find myself teaching my students the most, I break it down internally to process, product, and purpose, because if you don't know how to improve upon the way you write, you'll struggle. If you don't know how to improve the thing you're writing, you struggle. If you don't know why you're writing, you'll struggle. Mm-hmm. And often all of the stuff we experience is symptomatic of one of those, if not a couple. But and I find that rubric helps it break down more easily for people, because then it's not this incomprehensible morass of things. It's, oh, I need to improve upon the way I do things, on what I'm doing, or get a better understanding of why I am doing it, to what end. And the thing I find most often is that people struggle with process and what they think a thing they're making should be versus what it is it emerging to be. So I find myself often saying to them, you already contain you, and this thing you're creating is greater than you. So give it somewhere else to be, because there's no room here. And trying to shove that into you and maintain you and grow that is lunacy. Importantly, too, when you let it exist somewhere outside of you, to your point, it has the opportunity to not be bound by everything that the internalities of you believe should be.
And this goes right into, for instance, Harold Bloom, when he wrote about, he has a book called Genius, okay, where he wrote about the greatest writers, the greatest dead writers, because he refuses to include living writers.
Probably a smart choice.
And he puts number one, Shakespeare. And he says, and he put it number one, in top of everything, because he's the only one that is fully empty. That is...
because he's a cipher, fundamentally. We don't actually know who he is.
Right. Because he can make this character and that character and this character, and they can be all characters and all are alive and all are being, and you don't see... like in bad writers, that you always get the same character always appearing because, you know...
Same character, same page, same plot, three books in a row, yeah.
And then you say, and who's that? It's him, of course. And
oh, yeah, the author avatar is a known
name. Yeah. Harold Bloom puts him on top exactly because he's the only one that is truly void.
You know, and I don't think he would have if Shakespeare lived now. Because then we'd have so much more record of who he was as a person to compare to the characters he writes.
I think he became void because he was hiding. You see, that's one of the things that appears in my book. This is my analysis, is that I think he was a hidden Catholic. Mm. And his family were from hidden Catholics. So he is not. I'm not saying that he is a religiously Catholic, but that he was more Catholic-leaning than Puritan-leaning.
It touches on Irving Goffman's public-facing self versus on and off-stage selves, who the actor appears to be versus who they are when no one's observing. Yeah. Effectively, the quantum performer.
Right.
We'll never know who they are without observation because we can only observe.
Right. And so I think that's the reason. And I don't think that he was... and this is actually not my analysis only. I mean, I base my analysis on the text written by a Shakespeare expert that wrote extensively about it, and I read his work. So it's not like me sitting and deciding on this. But my impression, and based on his analysis of the structure of his dramas, is that he considers the Puritan ideal of the kind of the abstaining of the flesh mm-hmm. to be full-hearted.
Because it means denial of what a human is.
Because it means denial of what a human.
Yourself is bound up into your physicality.
Right.
Even if you believe that the most essential part of self pre-exists the physicality and will persist after it.
Right.
That effectively, to go back to what I was saying about if you were to give an artificial or to give an external existence a physical human form, it could only truly understand being what a human was if it had the human form and human existence.
Right. And I think that goes to the answers of what the soul is, which is the question that we're going around in that direction, which is the issue of if a soul is using the concept of Shannon information, okay, that is transported around. What happens with Shannon information is that once it dissipates to the environment, because the system cannot preserve all of it, it collapses into a subset. And this is how quantum reality becomes classical reality, because Shannon information is sent to the environment. And so the quantum system that existed in all possible worlds or all possible alternatives is collapsed into a single alternative. Because once you give this information away to the environment, the system cannot hold that. It has to collapse.
You are going back to your complete or universal. The moment you break, the moment you crack the jar open, the moment you tip it out, you don't actually control how much is dissipated or lost. It's just
right.
Whatever stressors or factors external to you affect that. And then what persists, and that remains as the thing known.
And that remains as the thing. And that's a novelty, you know. Of all the things you could be, suddenly only one of them can be, okay? And that's the novelty. That's the path. And so information has this capacity. Information is a little bit like Shiva of the Hindu. It's creation and destruction.
Right, because having it allows for creation, but an overflow of it destroys everything.
Destroys everything. And so, and it's basically, if it's too strong, it makes an empty slate of everything else and starts anew. The issue of soul is my concept, using physics concept, is the part of the information that is two things, in you / characterizes you to the world.
Right. There's the expression of the individual. Yeah.
So it's your characteristics as an individual, but it's also your image into the world. At least we know that the part that is within us in our body might disappear when our body dies or not. Depends on the religious tradition.
Right.
But the part of us that is outside, that would surely remain.
Even if it's just a particle.
Even if it's just a particle, even if it's just, you know, my footprint on a beach that will remain for millions of years and someone will grow up and say, look, there's a foot here.
There is, I'm forgetting the name of the movie now, but there's a scene in it, and I think we'll end on this, where the main character is sitting on the beach and there's a crab that she talks to and he says his name is Morgan Freeman with a D. And it's by a Morgan Freeman impersonator. And he paraphrases the whole Shawshank Redemption end. And at the very end, he goes, I've had a good life, and walks back to the ocean and says, goodbye, me. And walks in. But it's that, it's cheeky, it's on the nose, but it's a moment that sticks with me because it's that there's an understanding to it.
Right. And you know what reminds me that, you know, at the beginning of the conversation, we're talking about the woke and what jokes that can be said and cannot be said. And I'm thinking, okay, all this is valid. But what makes me laugh? Is it the old Bugs Bunny or the new Little Mermaid? And in my mind, there is not a moment hesitation of which one is actually true. Now, you might try to pretend that actually this is not true. But hey, what's up, Doc?
Mel Blanc was a... You know, talk about a void, not a void per se, but like a realm into himself of voices and characters. I was listening to an interview with his family. Even when he was comatose, they could get some level of engagement from Bugs Bunny or others from him because somehow they were still there. in the brain and other parts of the brain. And, you know, they've seen with folks who are have degenerative brain disorders, music or other things will still stimulate a part of them, which suggests that the self is not an individual, is a composite. It's not a singular entity.
Right.
And I think we rely on stories to create a vessel for the soul outside of us so that more can persist than would otherwise.
Yeah. But the point that I'm trying to make is I think we have forgotten our ridiculousness. I think the problem of the woke is that we, this new generation, is having a problem of consider themselves to be extremely important without having the need to actually do something to justify that importance. Do you understand what I'm?
I do, and I'm 40, so I'm going to sound like an old fogey to them anyway when I say anything.
Well, I'm 50, so I'm
okay. So, by matter order of relevancy, you'll make what I say better then. I think this is a thing we all struggle with because, again, a lot of the folks who grew up online now, and I've had this conversation with Ken, who's been on the show too. The internet is a lot of things. At its best, it is an environment that allows people who could not share things about themselves to do so. At its worst, it is an environment for people who could not share things about themselves to do so. Mm-hmm. And the problem becomes that, I think to your notion of privacy or social structures, et cetera, we are encountering people we probably never would have, to an extent we never would have, to a degree of them expressing their random human conflicting thoughts that we all have, as we have the means to share them without enough moderation or temperance to think better of, in some cases, acting on or sharing them. And to a certain extent, we are reacting to each other's worst, stupidest, most immediate thoughts too often. And it's much easier to hate someone else that you don't know when they say a thing that's hurtful, intentionally or not, or to assume someone has ill intent when they're confused. I was reading a thread, this is ages back, where it was very common on certain parts of Twitter to, make stupid men jokes. And a guy responded and said, I get that I speak from a position of power as a member of the patriarchy, intentionally or not, but those jokes still hurt. And the counters were, well, you guys earned it. And he's saying, yeah, but it still hurts. I get that maybe it doesn't hurt as much as me making jokes about minorities would, because there's power involved in whether or not I will suffer consequences. And part of what we're looking at is a course correction where, yeah, people who had the power to protect themselves from the things they said, look at Kanye sharing his anti-Semitic views. He is legally free and should legally be free to say that in the States, just as the companies he works with should be free to say, you know what, we don't want you to represent who we are.
Of course.
And I think that is a hard reality to live in, because it means watching our presidential candidates, our leaders, watching Florida argue about whether or not slavery should be on their resume. And that seems, I think, to anyone outside the U.S., an absurd statement. How could a reasonable human being argue that there were good things, good work skills learned from slavery, and have the curriculum be modified?
You mean the advantage to the enslaved relative to the non-enslaved?
In Florida, they're trying to modify their curriculum to say that some slaves were happy and learned good work skills from their enslavement. And while that is perhaps...
I very much doubt that the type of slavery that existed in Florida allowed for that. On the other hand, if you look at the history of Europe, of the Roman Empire,
sure,
basically everyone was a slave. I mean, like, or descendant of slaves, or cousin of slaves.
Yeah, I'm limiting the context here to slavery in the States, although that is also shaped by slavery in the world around it too, because it was a global situation.
And the reason I mentioned is that I don't know about the slavery. You see, the history of slavery is a very tricky thing, because sometimes I'm in the internet and I find interesting things or funny things or intriguing things. Slavery is a very old process.
Yes.
And the true history of slavery is that black slavery was started by black strong groups that enslaved neighboring black tribes.
Right, and that Vikings had a whole hierarchy of indentured servitude to slavery that gets whitewashed in our fantasization of it now, by and large.
You know, the word slave comes from Slav, which means people, basically means people from Ukraine. So basically that's the word. And when in the old Roman text, the enemies of Christianity said that Jesus had blue eyes, they didn't mean that Jesus had blue eyes as a compliment. It means that he looked like a slave.
Yes. The reason I bring this up, though, is that it's become a national discourse, unsurprisingly, because our history with the actions of slavery and the consequences of it is fraught. The arguments over whether or not there are systemic remnants of that persisting is fraught. The act of revising our educational materials so that generations can grow up and feel that they're disconnected or have no connection to this history is disastrous. And it's not a thing online that you can easily converse about, because I think, to go back to your example of Kissinger, and I've read anecdotes of this too, where individuals have tried to sit down with folks they didn't agree with and said, look, I don't get you. I'm not hoping one conversation will solve it, but I would dearly love to have at least a little better understanding of why you think the way you do, so that I don't hate you as much, so that I see you as a person as opposed to part of a monstrosity that persists. And I think that the thing we struggle with now, that woke was co-opted into, because fundamentally woke emerged out of Black and minority cultures to describe people who are willing to acknowledge that the issues persist and continue, that you're not nodding off to the American dream that we have a Black president, racism is fixed, that affirmative action existed, racism is fixed, that there are not cultural or financial inequalities dependent upon the region. All woke fundamentally meant was that you were willing to not assume the story was the totality. And it got co-opted into the fight on cancel culture, which had at its heart an intent of providing a richer, deeper narrative to individuals that have achieved status or achieved levels of fame and power. It was initially an effort to speak truth to power. But I think, to your point there, when you perpetuate the conversation eternally online and systems that invite people to stay on the angrier they are, and algorithms that queue up more content to make them more frustrated and angry, you create a bad faith environment for conversation where you're going to be fed the worst examples of the opposition on whatever side you're on. You're going to react to that and then become fodder for them. And it's very hard on a social media scale to see a simple brief slice of a thing a human being has said and see the human being, to see the quoted post and still see a soul, right? It's very hard to find the soul on a post.
A good story can excite us, yes. But the best ones, fiction or not, compel, inspire, or drive us toward the hope that we need for a better life. Remember, you don't need to know everything right now, but you do need to write. So make sure to like, review, and subscribe to us at Here Be Tigers. And until next time, take life by the tail.